come back to the room if you'd like to come up. Probably a number of you have met Venerable Joseph Paulo before. He's visited 6 times.
He tends to migrate through this area quite often.
We're very fortunate about that. And you know, it's really wonderful getting to know some of the monastics. We've been able to meet Ajahn Chah Nicole, and maybe this May we'll have a visiting female Ajahn, Ajahn Thanissati. It's not confirmed yet, but we're hoping to have a visit. Thanks. In part, Venerable Joseph Paulo kind of expressing our wishes to the right people. So, one of the great things about having Venerable Joseph Paulo come year after year now for several years is he just, at least for me and maybe other people who've been close, see just what the effect of a monastic life can be. I just get the sense every time I meet you, Venerable Joseph Paulo, that there's a quality of stillness and purity, and it's just really nice to be around you. So it's great to have you here. Venerable Joseph Paulo has been practicing as a Buddhist monk, starting with Anagarika and then with the novice year, and 8 years as a fully ordained Buddhist monk. So that's 10 years in the monastery already. Before that, on staff at IMS, which is kind of its own monastery of sorts for lay people. And even before that, he lived at Kopala. Some of you heard of that well-known yoga place in Lenox, Massachusetts.
Yes.
So he has a long history of being interested in spiritual life and then really taking it by the horns and becoming a Buddhist monk. And especially in this tradition that he's going to talk about tonight, in the lineage of Ajahn Chah, coming out of the Thai forest tradition. One of the traditions in Buddhism that is dedicated to trying to live as the monks and nuns lived at the time of the Buddha. I mean, obviously things have changed quite a bit, but really working with the principle of renunciation in different aspects of life and appreciating the simplicity of life. So thank you again for coming.
So I'm happy Mark mentioned that about the nuns community, because I was going to start by talking about that. Let me start off first. In the Ajahn Chah tradition in the West, mainly in Europe and North America, we kind of consider ourselves to be disciples of Ajahn Chah and Ajahn Sumedho. And if you're not familiar with the Thai language, Ajahn is a title meaning teacher, and you'll also will hear referred to both of them, Ajahn Chah and Ajahn Sumedho, is referred to as Lumpur Chah or Lumpur Sumedho. So if I might mix those terms up, but I'm referring to the same people. And right now, all the nuns are training over in Europe or in Australia. That's where their main monasteries are. And just a couple of weeks ago, the nuns were talking with us about just starting the beginning process of sending nuns more to the United States to hopefully develop a community here. So there'll be training opportunities for women in the United States. Right now, if people do want to train, they have to go to Europe, which is not very convenient. but it is possible. So that's just really good news. I think this winter they're going to be in California area, but there's no reason that, you know, that's where they're going to organize. It's just that's probably where the, I say, main lay support for Ajahn Chah's monasteries are now is California. But that will, I think they have some other invitations like Texas and the East Coast, so, and Common Grounds. So it's just nice to see that happening. And, you know, it's kind of timely maybe this talk then, because I was really just kind of hoping to, more than anything, sort of just introduce who Ajahn Chah is, that, you know, sort of, there's a Abhayagiri Buddhist monastery, which is in Northern California. That's where I ordained and have lived most of my monastic life. And then there's actually three monasteries in Canada, so we're falling behind the Canadians in terms of monasticism. There's one in British Columbia, who's Ajahn Sona. He also he ordained a Bhavana Society in West Virginia, so he also has connections with Bhante Gunaratna and the Sri Lankan community, but he also did most of his training in Thailand with my teacher. And then in Arrow River, which we mentioned Ajahn Punadamo, who I think is going to be here in a couple of weeks, 3 weeks, three weeks or so. And then he's also going to be teaching at the Christine Center in February. And then Ajahn Chandako comes through quite often too. So, he's not there. But then there's also a third monastery in Canada that just opened last year called Tisarana in Ottawa. And so there's starting to be quite a few, you know, large sort of developing of Ajahn Chah's tradition. So just I think it's a good question. Well, who was Ajahn Chah? And it's interesting because I'm not qualified to answer that question because I never met him. He passed away in 1992. And he'd been in a coma for 10 years before that. So it wasn't even until a couple of years after he passed away that I actually even became interested in Buddhism. But, you know, all of my training as a monastic and most of my lay teachers, or not lay teachers, but my ordained teachers were his disciples. So it's like I get to see, you know, sort of him through my teachers. And it is quite interesting that, you know, how everybody, you know, perceives people differently. And so if you read, I listened to a lot of tapes of this one particular Ajahn in our tradition, Ajahn Jayasaro. He was trying to take a book that had been written, a biography of Ajahn Chah, after he had passed away. It was just in Thai, and it was a really thick book. And he was trying to make it accessible to Westerners, and he kept rewriting it and rewriting it and rewriting it. And after 15 years and about 10 rewrites, he finally just threw the whole thing in the, he said no, he wouldn't do it. And partly he was frustrated because he would write it, and then he'd have some of the other senior monks, you know, read it, and they're like, well, that's not what I perceived. You know, they have completely different, you know, perceptions. And Ajahn Jayasaro kind of saw himself as sort of being somebody who's really ascetic and like to get out there and really work hard and take on, you know, the practices, you know, really sternly. And so when you read his accounts of Ajahn Chah, that's what it sounds like, that way Ajahn Chah taught. And the two very senior monks, Western monks, Ajahn Chah, one of them is my teacher, Ajahn Pasano. And he runs the monastery very, very tightly. We have every morning, just about, there's a morning chanting a couple hours before dawn, and then every evening there's also a group meditation, and this happens basically 5 or 6 days a week, and then there's only like one day that we don't do that. So it's, you know, a real tight schedule. But then Ajahn Brahmavangso, who's in Australia, he's only 1 year junior to Ajahn Pasano. His monastery is completely open. Like, they really hardly ever have meetings. He'd rather the monks practicing their kutis and the nuns practicing their kutis and just, you know, developing solitude and concentration. And if you ask both of them why they run the monasteries that way, and they say, well, that's because of the way Ajahn Chah taught. Okay. And I was in Thailand. I was kind of perplexed by this, and I was visiting Ajahn Anand, who's a very well-respected Thai monk who was also a disciple of Ajahn Chah. And so I posed that question to him, and he told me exactly that. And I said, so what's the deal? He said, there is a middle way. So he said, yeah, sometimes I didn't shout out that way, and sometimes you talk that way, and so they're both right. But Ajahn Chah was born in the northeast part of Thailand, very close to where Laos and Cambodia and Thailand all sort of meet. And it was a really small village. Probably the name of it has changed, but now it's called the village of Bon Gor. And this was in 1918 that Ajahn Chah was born. And he grew up in, a well-to-do family for, say, the 1920s or 30s of Thailand. So his parents were farmers, probably well-to-do meant that they owned their own water buffaloes, and he didn't really, starving or poverty in that sort of sense wasn't a problem. And his family was known for its generosity, but that really wasn't, that's fairly common, because in that area, most of the people in the Isan, which is the northeast part of Thailand, a lot of them consider themselves also to be Lao, or they have very strong Lao influences in that part of the country. The generosity is very, very common. So, if people needed help with planting the rice or harvesting the rice, and people had time, they would actually help each other out and things like this, or just so it's just a very common way of growing up. As Ajahn Chah was growing up, I wish I had brought it, but there's one of the monks at our branch monastery in Thailand for Westerners did the whole series of drawings and paintings of Ajahn Chah's life for the very first book that came out. And there's a couple of really humorous drawings of Ajahn Chah playing with his playmates when he was growing up. And it was said that he always was sort of like the leader of the gang. And he would play as being a monk. So he would set himself up on a higher seat than everybody else and sit there and have them bring him fruit and rice and stuff like this, and he'd accept it, and then he'd give them blessings and he'd do chanting for them and stuff like that. And so he was quite charismatic right from the cradle, it sounds like. But at the age of 9, on his own initiative, he actually asked to go to the monastery. So it's not uncommon for families to send their children, especially in situations of poverty where they couldn't quite take care of the children and stuff like that. The monasteries in many ways became a social net. And that actually still works in Thailand to this day that way. So it actually can be quite easy to get critical, visiting Thailand and seeing the monasteries and seeing the novices not really behaving or following the rules and stuff. But in some ways it's really wholesome that they actually have that opportunity and they're getting some good influence. But Ajahn Chah, on his own initiative, he was fed up with the world. He just thought it was too much work and too much hassle, and was feeling dispassion. And there's a humorous story where he was working with his brother and his sisters and his brothers, and they were pounding rice, and there's a kind of like this stone that sort of goes up and down, and you kind of do it with a foot pedal. And I guess something had come loose, and the kids were all trying to get it back together, and Ajahn Chah wouldn't have anything to do with it, and was sitting back. And in the process of them putting it back in, he got hit on top of the head with the mallet, and he just got really angry and said, "That's it, I'm going to the monastery." And so, as Ajahn Chah said, it's not a very auspicious way to declare one's intentions to lead the holy life. But he lived in the monastery for about 6 or 7 years. And then kind of a humorous story was that, so it was in the local village, so he was able to see his parents every day, actually, sort of going on alms rounds and see his family, and they could come and visit him at the monastery. But occasionally he would be able to go back home and visit family. And there was a particular senior monk who would accompany Ajahn Chah whenever he went back, and Ajahn Chah had responsibilities to this monk, but they help clean his robes and clean his kuti and things like that, or wash his alms bowl, just sort of duties like that. And then, so this Ajahn Lung was his name, and he would go back and with Ajahn Chah, and then the visits started becoming more and more often at Ajahn Lung's advice, and there'd be longer and longer visits when they were there. And then one day, this Ajahn told Ajahn Chah that he was going to disrobe, and planted a seed or sort of suggested that Ajahn Chah might want to do the same thing. he was like a child of 16 at the time. He hadn't really, you know, thought much about it either way. And he just, it was enough for him to decide to disrobe. So he did. Then it turned out that Ajahn Lung then married Ajahn Chah's sister. So there was an alternative there that he didn't know about. But anyway, Ajahn Chah went back to the, just to, you know, being a teenager. And for a while, he just sort of led a, you know, a normal life. He was working, you know, on the family's farm, basically rice farming and things like that. And it was said that he had, he was just, I would say, just a normal sort of teenager's life. And in Thailand at that time, they would have like these festivals, which are called a Nong. And it's interesting in the Thai language that that word festival is also the same word as for work. So that gives you really kind of good insight into the Thai people. They like having fun, so work is a festival. And but these would be, like, they'd be these traveling sort of circuses, not want to say circuses, but sort of performances, stuff would go around to the villages, and there'd be these festivals. And say it would not be uncommon for Ajahn Chah and his friends to sort of walk, say, 10, 15 miles after sort of farming all day, go to these parties and festivals, and then walk back that night to be back to the fields the next morning. So he had a lot of energy for a 16-year-old. His best friend was a man named Poot, who's his same age. And then, so he got to know Poot really well. And then he actually fell in love with Poot's stepsister. Her name was Jai. And just it sort of slowly developed over time. And then they both fell in love, and they're actually planning to get married. But most Thai men back at this time wouldn't marry until they'd actually ordained as a fully ordained monk for a period of time, at least 3 months, maybe a year or two. And he also had to make sure, before he could become a monk, he had to see if he had to do military service. So this time, I think he was probably about 18 years old or so. And so he was still looking like, even if he did want to, if they were able to get married, it was going to be 2 or 3 years before they'd be able to do that. And then for economic reasons, Poots and Jai's parents decided to marry the two children together. And so, Ajahn Chah said that was just, you know, completely sort of shocking to him that happened. He said there was no, he didn't blame Poot or anything like that. And they actually remained lifelong friends until the very end. He actually helped found Wakpokong, the monastery Ajahn Chah taught. And he said, Ajahn Pazin says he came to the monastery all the time. So they still remain friends. With Jai, he still had, even after he'd become a monk and things like that, he said he still had to keep his distance from her, because at the beginning, when his practice wasn't very strong, that he said, you know, if something had happened to Poot, he wasn't sure that he wouldn't have disrobed and gone back. He was like that in love with her. But then this experience, and then also just sort of this feeling, sort of disillusioned with the world in other ways. When he did turn 20, which is the age that you have to be before you can take full ordination, so when he did turn 20, then he ordained in the local temple again. And at this particular temple, the main emphasis was on study. So it's like he was studying Pali and sort of introductory Dhamma courses. In Thailand, there's a series of exams that you have to pass for a monk. And if you pass, I think it's the third level of exams, then you're actually able to qualify to be an abbot of a monastery. So it's sort of a big thing. It's still very common that monks will spend a lot of time studying for these. And it's like the exams are only given once a year. And so like the monks will study for most of the year for that one exam. And there's also Pali exams, and then those go actually further up to, like, I think 12 levels, and it's quite an honor to get up into the higher levels. So this was April 26, 1939, is when Ajahn Chah had been ordained as a monk. And also at this monastery, there probably was no no meditation instructions, or if there were, it was given very little importance. So it was he was not, you know, not a meditation monk at that point when he first ordained. And then he sort of lived in this environment for, I couldn't really tell by reading the biography, but somewhere between, say, 5 and 7 years when he was in this village monastery. He may have traveled, I forget exactly, but around just a few other monasteries, you know, because in other different monasteries, there actually would be better teachers at the courses that he was taking. And so he actually did do some traveling, but it was just sort of in the local area. It never would have been more than, say, 40 or 50 miles away, I don't think, from his home village. And then it was right before he'd been studying all year long for his third and sort of final Dhamma exam when he got the bad news that his father had fell seriously ill. And so he was really sort of struggling with, well, should I, you know, just sort of wait a couple of weeks and take the exam, and or, you know, sort of forget the whole year and go back and stay with his father. But Thai culture is you're very close with your family. And so it was like no question. So he just went back and nursed his father. And then that actually became a very critical factor in his life. And sort of very quickly seeing his father, his health deteriorating. And he's kind of talked about later, it's just sort of like all the dhammas that he'd been studying, just about aging, sickness and death and decay and all these things, just became real for him, just right in front of his eyes, you know, nursing his father. And his father had oftentimes asked, he was really happy that Ajahn Chah was a monk, and he'd asked him many times to stay in the robes, told him that, you know, I think that's the best life for you. And Ajahn Chah would never commit. He'd smile and he wouldn't say anything. But then when he saw his, right before his father died, his father asked him again to stay in the robes. Ajahn Chah agreed, and he said he meant it. And so it was and it was very shortly after that he died. And then he went back to the monastery, and I couldn't quite tell the time, but I think he did pass his third year exams. And then he was put into a lot more sort of teaching responsibilities after that. And then he got even more disillusioned sort of with the village monastic life, just because he felt like the students that he was training, you know, oftentimes they were, you know, say these young kids, and they didn't want to be there, and he just didn't see any enthusiasm in his disciples, or it actually weren't his disciples, but his students. And then he was also doing a lot of sort of Dhamma reading on his own, and he just felt like the examples that he was reading in the suttas of the, say, the Arhant disciples of the Buddha, like Sariputta and Mahamoggallana and Mahakasapa, just the example that all these monks were showing in the suttas, that he was looking at his life and he didn't see any similarities. So he was starting to look, thinking that his own training or his own lifestyle wasn't what he was, you know, why he ordained, or getting what he could. So at this, he was the age, he was 28 at this point, and he decided, I think I've heard some stories where he had actually seen some Tudong monks come through. He had been exposed to Tudong monks, which are wandering monks, or forest monks, and as compared to, say, village monks who spent most of their time studying. And the forest monks, or these Tudong monks, were also known as for meditation, and so he set out to find some meditation monks. And it's quite surprising at that time, so this would have been 1946, there actually were very few meditation monks in the Ubon, in the northeast part of Thailand. And the reason for that was that the Dhammayut, there's two different sort of sects of Buddhism in Thailand, very, very similar in many ways, but one's called the Dhammayut order, and one's the Mahanikai. And the majority of monks in Thailand are Mahanikai, and that's actually what I am, which is kind of rare for a forest monk. Most forest monks are Dhammayut, and Ajahn Mun was a Dhammayut monk. But this administrator who was put in the Ubon area didn't like or didn't trust forest monks, because for various reasons, but mainly because they were coming from their own experiences, from their meditation, not from the books. And it was kind of hard to sort of regulate, you know, what they did. So he made it very difficult for Ajahn Mun and his disciples. So basically they all left that part of the country. And so then when Ajahn Chah decided, you know, if he wanted to study, he had to leave the northeast to go find a teacher. And he ended up going to Saraburi province, which is, I guess, fairly close to, maybe a little bit north of Bangkok, is that right? Okay. But it's about 250 miles away from where he lived. Now, at that point in the 1940s, say Thailand was still maybe 60 to somewhere 80% jungle. So it wasn't like he just sort of jumped on a train or he just got on a bus. He had to walk. And he went with one other monk. And so it was, you know, he was really being a Tudong monk or just a wandering monk, and you had to deal with the hardships of uncertainty about where he's going to sleep, how to get food because the villages weren't that close by and you maybe didn't know the area, the fear and danger of wild animals, mainly mosquitoes, malaria and other diseases like that. But still there were tigers and elephants and snakes and all sorts of dangers. But also a very real fear for many Thais is the spirit world. So, being out in the jungles. And if I have time, I'm going to maybe read. I don't think I'm going to have time, but there's this great account where Ajahn Chah decides to go out and spend the night in a charnel ground. And this is like terrifying to most Thai people. And he goes and sets up his place, and then he's sitting there. He thinks this isn't going to be so bad. And then the villagers carry in a corpse, and they come over and they bury it right next to where he is. And it was a child, and he's just frightened to death. And he doesn't sleep all night. And just, he described it here. It's just it's a horrible night and stuff. And then the day breaks, and he's thinking, yes, I did it. Great, that was nothing, no problem. And then he does get a little bit of sleep during the day, and then he's thinking, I should really have some great meditation tonight, because I made it through, the corpse there and everything. And then, in this book, I like the wording of it. He says, wouldn't you know it, just right before dark, they carry in a big one. And they carry in another body, and they cremate it right next to a spot again. And then he describes sort of being up, he just completely, fearful of the spirit world and stuff like that. And he's sitting there in meditation, and the body's burning behind him. He describes very vividly what it's, the smells and the sounds and stuff like that. And then all of a sudden he hears these footsteps coming from the fire. And he's like, it sounds like a water buffalo, but it's not. It sounds like a person, but it's not. And it comes and walks up behind him and sort of circles around and goes off into the forest. And he's like, what in the world is that? And then about 10 minutes later, it comes running back. It comes right up to him. And he decided he's not going to open his eyes. He's just, if this kills me, let it kill me, And it comes up, and he says he can feel the fire from its hands, sort of right in front of its face. And he describes this, this total fear sort of welling up in his body. He says it's like a glass that is overflowing. It's completely full of water, and you put more in, it just overflows. And that's what happened with this fear. So it was completely full of fear, and then it broke and it like overflowed. And then he said this voice came into his head that said, "What are you afraid of?" And then this other voice said, "I'm afraid of death." This conversation is happening, and he's not even sort of really asking the question, but it's just spontaneously coming up. And this voice says, "Well, where is death?" And this other voice says, "Well, death is within you." And then he's like, "Well, if it's within me, it's like, then where, if I run away, it goes with me." And then immediately the fear went completely away. And it was just, he said it was a very, extremely profound experience, because like in one second there had been nothing but fear, and then just, he said, just turning over your hand, that's fear, there's no fear. Just like that, it just completely went away. And just, the power of insight, that was just a very powerful moment for him. So that happened, I think, during the phase where he was a wandering monk, and so that happened. I mean, that happened a little bit later. So what happened here first was that he walked to Saraburi province, which is the approximately 250 miles from where he grew up in the monasteries he was at. And he originally went to, he found a place or heard about a place called Wat Khao Wongkot. And there was a famous meditation teacher there named Ajahn Pao, and he was a disciple of Ajahn Mun. And it was when he got there, he could tell it was just a really good monastery because the way that they had kept the monastery was, you know, extremely clean and pristine. It just had this real sense of silence, and it was just really deep. But it just turned out that Ajahn Pao had died like the week before he got there. But his students were there, and they could sort of help Ajahn Chah with you know, meditation. And it was just before the beginning of a rains retreat. And a rains retreat is during the monsoon season. The monks are required to stay in a monastery. So he decided that, you know, they'd already walked that way, and it was a good place, so they stayed. And then he had the good fortune that when he was there, one of the laymen who was sort of helping around the monastery had been living with Ajahn Mun. And it just turns out that Ajahn Mun had moved from the north of Thailand back to Ubon in that area. It was actually, let's see if I wrote down, Sakhon Nakhon province, which is kind of the northeast part of the northeast. And so after the rains retreat, then Ajahn Chah walked the 250 miles back to his home province, and then it was about 160 miles north of where it was in the Phupan Mountains is where Ajahn Mun was staying. And so Ajahn Chah and a group of monks went to go see him. And it ends up, I think, like only three of them actually sort of made the whole journey. Some of them turned back, so it wasn't an easy journey. And then Ajahn Chah actually only spent 3 days with Ajahn Mun. So when he arrived there, he spent like, he got 2 days of teachings from Ajahn Mun. And let me see, I might read this one. There's a new book we're hoping to produce at the monastery. In this book, was Food for the Heart by Wisdom. Yeah, Wisdom Publications. There's an introduction to it that one of the abbots at Abhayagiri wrote. And so that's going to be in this new pre-distribution book. And then also I've got a manuscript here of that Ajahn Chah, or Ajahn Jayasaro, who said he was writing all these accounts and stuff. We finally wrestled a couple chapters of the book away from him, and we're going to publish them. So it's the beginning years. I guess I don't have that marked. But basically, Ajahn Chah, the insight that he got from being with others, two. One was that Ajahn Chah was really perplexed by the monks' rules. There's 227 monastic rules, and I was talking about this the other night. There's about 10,000 etiquette rules, and Ajahn Chah was like, you can't keep all this in your head. How can you live this? And Ajahn Mun sort of said that basically, if you take hearing otapa, do you know the translation of that word? How would you
try? I've been using wholesome fear and wholesome regret.
Yeah. So those, and these are wholesome qualities. So it's not like so it's just things that help you keep on the right track. These qualities, and so Ajahn Mun said, you know, you just really keep that as your guide in life, and then you try to memorize the rules as best you can to use them. But then the second night, he got this instructions where Ajahn Chah had some doubts, or Ajahn Mun was talking, and he laid out really clearly the distinction between thoughts and the mind. And he was just talking about how we usually get, when a thought comes into our minds, we think that that's real and that's who and what we are. And then Ajahn Mun really, you know, picked that apart and really showed him that the two are quite different, and that the, you know, mind states just come and go, and you're impermanent, but the mind can be steady. And this, when Ajahn Chah heard that, it was like, you know, all his doubts sort of went away about the practice. And and it's interesting, if you read then his writings, it comes up almost in every single talk, you know, just sort of this theme. And it just, Ajahn Chah talked about that in many different ways. So he just spent those 3 days and he left. But there's many instances later in Sylvia's next period of time when he was still wandering that he had, I don't know how you describe it, but just sort of like, well, like one of the instances is he mentions that he was in a forest and he was sitting, he just had a mosquito netting around him at night, and this pack of wild dogs came and surrounded him and were starting to bite at the mosquito netting. And Ajahn Chah, again, is just sort of, well, if it's my time to die, it's my time to die. And he just made his mind peaceful. And then out of nowhere, this light came through the forest, and it was Ajahn Mun, and came and sort of yelled at the dogs, and the dogs disappeared. But Ajahn Mun was not there. You know, so it was, who knows what was happening, some sort of psychic powers or something. But this happened several times with Ajahn Chah. Or he would a couple times, like he'd have a dream, and Ajahn Mun would actually give him a piece of information that he needed in his meditation or things like this. So there was some sort of connection happening there. And even though Ajahn Chah only spent 3 days with Ajahn Mun, he considered himself an Ajahn Mun disciple. So if anyone asked him who his teacher was, he gave credit to Ajahn Mun for sort of any sort of wisdom that he ever had or anything that he developed or all of Wat Pho Phong and stuff like that. He said that was a direct result of what he got from Ajahn Mun. So, one interesting, after he'd been sort of being a wandering monk for about 7 or 8 years, he was getting to a point in his meditation where he described it was he could enter into pretty deep states of concentration, be very peaceful, had lots of energy, you know, hardly slept at all, hardly ate at all. But someplace in his meditation, he'd get to a place where he felt like he couldn't go any further. You know, I don't know if any of us have ever had that experience. But he said it would be like walking across a bridge, and he'd get halfway across and the bridge would end, and there was just no way to go forward, and didn't know what to do. Or he'd be walking in a forest, and he'd come across stone wall or something and no way to get beyond it, so he'd turn around and go back. And that was sort of, you know, this analogy for what he was happening in his meditation. And so he went to this Ajahn Wan, who's another Ajahn Mun disciple, and sort of described the situation to him, and it was really profound. Just Ajahn Wan sort of said, well, what you've reached is the end of perception. And I was like, wow. And it was a little bit, some more little teachings to that. And then what Ajahn Wan told me, he says, so when you reach this, it's just the end of perception, is that even though you can't perceive it, you can be aware of it. And so when you get to that point, just be aware of it, and then just because of the law of impermanence, it will change on its own. And then Ajahn Chah was like, yes, okay. And then he went and he studied. He was at his monastery and he was up on a mountain. And so he went for just 2 days and just threw himself totally into the practice and with new vigor. And then on the third day, it must be something with threes with Ajahn Chah, because then he left that monastery. And then said when he got to the base of the mountain, it started raining. And then there was an abandoned monastery there. So he went in and he started contemplating the four elements, the earth, water, fire, and air, and started just using this as a contemplation. And he said just immediately his whole world just shifted upside down. It was like he said everything he saw, I kind of get the image of the Matrix where Neo sort of realizes that he's the one, and then everything just sort of shifts. And he said he was looking at a spittoon, and all of a sudden it wasn't a spittoon, it was just elements. And then it shifted back to being a spittoon, and he looked at a water pitcher, and the same thing happened. And everything he looked at, he was seeing, and he was seeing the conventional reality and the ultimate reality sort of shifting back and forth. And then he said he took that sort of same perception into his body. And then it sounds like the way he describes it is that was sort of his stream entry. That's where he attained the first of the four stages of enlightenment. And then, after having that experience, a little bit during this sort of period where he was wandering, what he would do is he would go and visit several elder monks who were also Mahanikai monks, who were forest monks. And and sort of receive teachings from them, and only stay with them for a short period of time, and then you'd go out and wander and find solitude and just practice in the forests, and then, you know, get to a point where you needed more training or had to go back to the monastery for the range retreats, and then we'd go back to the monastery. That most of it was in solitude or just with one or two other monks. But after having this experience, he went back, and one of his teachers was Ajahn Ginri, and he explained to him what had happened, and Ajahn Ginri said, okay, you don't need to go on Tudong anymore. You can establish, your training's done. And not that it was finished totally, but it was time for him. He didn't need to do the wandering practice anymore. So that would have been 1953, and then he established a monastery. It was 10 days walk from where he lived, and started having disciples started to gather around him at that point. And then it was after that particular range retreat that Ajahn Chah's mother and some other people from the village and his friend Poot as well came and asked him to start a monastery in their area. And it was the Paphong Forest was there. And so at that time, there were still large tracts of land that were completely unclaimed. And this one was still had tigers in it and wild animals, and malaria was still there. So it was quite a big forest. And nobody ever wanted to go there because it's the spirit world too. And so Ajahn Chah thought that was perfect. And so it didn't take long. He accepted it, and then they went there. So the last part, though, I won't get into hardly anything about his teachings. We can talk about that later, or maybe 6 months from now when I'm back again. That seems to be the trend. We can talk about that. But a significant thing about Ajahn Chah was his death, the way he died. It would have been in about 1980, he started having signs of an illness coming on, dizziness and fainting spells. And they took him to Bangkok a couple times to doctors, and they couldn't really tell what was going on. And they did a experimental operation on his brain, and then that didn't work. And then it was very shortly after that he fell into a coma. And it was quite difficult for the community because Ajahn Chah sort of foresaw it happening, and to give sort of some professorial talks that, like, he wasn't going to be around very much longer. And I think he had actually said too that he did not want life support. He didn't want any sort of. He just wanted to pass away naturally. And what happened was, I got this from Ajahn Jayasaro, one of his talks was that like the first time that something like when he was at the monastery and like he started to have a seizure or something like that. You know, it was just so painful for the attendants who were there, and there was a doctor there, and the doctor said, well, we can do this. And they're like, yes, do anything just to get them to, you know, stop that. And then once they went down that road, you know, once you've done one procedure, then it's hard to say, okay, now we can't do it. So they ended up doing this for 10 years. And it was quite, I wouldn't say it was very controversial within the community, but it was amazing, though, that they did everything in harmony. So, like, there were very strongly different opinions about how to take care of them and what they should do, but they did make the decisions as a community, and so, you know, they all kept together. And so, in many ways, Ajahn Chah, say, because communities are very unique, that in Thailand, if you look at most of Ajahn Mun's disciples, and he had hundreds of sort of enlightened disciples, and their monasteries became quite large and prosperous when the disciples were still alive. But then once those teachers died, very quickly the monasteries disintegrated because it's like they were centered around a very charismatic teacher. And then it's very common, so it's nothing wrong, but it's just the way things go. But with Ajahn Chah, because it was very long illness and this being in a coma for 10 years, all of his disciples had to learn how to work together. And even while Ajahn Chah was alive, he was unique also in the Thai forest tradition that he stressed community life. Most of the Thai forest monks stressed, say, the Vinaya, which is the discipline, and meditation, but not so much community life. And Ajahn Chah stressed all three of those. So then when he did go in the coma, the community had to learn how to make decisions together. So I think when he died, there were about 40 monasteries and only a handful in the West. And I think now there's over 150 and you know, probably almost 20 monasteries in the West. So it's still growing because of growing now. So it's Ajahn Chah's interesting that way. And another interesting thing was that because Ajahn Chah only spent 3 days with Ajahn Mun, but was sort of, you know, associated with that lineage and practiced in that way as well. When Ajahn Chah then did start to teach, he wasn't confined to any sort of model or sort of, you know, say hierarchy in the Ajahn Mun system. So he was sort of part of it, but outside of it. So then when he started teaching, like he could have meetings all the time, or he could stress the community life, where if he had been a close associate with Ajahn Mun, he probably would have been criticized and told not to do that. So in many ways, his distance. And then also that fact about the Ubon just not having any forest monks. So when he went back, he wasn't Dhammayut, so the Dhammayut administrator couldn't give him a hard time. So it's just very unique kind of situation, like how, because it is interesting, it's like, you know, this basically, you know, a rice farmer from Thailand, you know, who was born in 1918, and, you know, when the funeral did happen, they said over 1 million people came through Wat Pho Phong, including the king and queen of Thailand, to, you know, pay their respects. So it's just, you know, fascinating that his little rice farmer can, mm-hmm. 1 million people can come to his funeral. You know, just shows what kind of, you know, individual he was, what kind of teachings, you know, he presented. I guess by ending though, if I didn't get into any of basically his teachings or writings and things, but I'm not a book salesman, so don't worry. But there is this Food for the Heart, which is it's a collection of actually all the books that the Wat Pho Phong and which is Ajahn Chah's monasteries, all the talks that over the years that all the monks and people have taken his teachings and done a free distribution. So there were many different books, and so they collected all of those and made this one collection of them. It's one of my favorite books. And then also Paul Breiter, who was one of the early Ajahn Chah disciples, a Western disciple, took a lot of his talks that he had never been translated and wrote Being Dharma, and this is by Shambhala. So there's a good picture of Ajahn Chah. And then this isn't so much about, it's not about Ajahn Chah at all, but it's actually more about the Chudong monks and Ajahn Mun's disciples. And this was, well, it's Kamala Tianovich's, and it's called Forest Recollections. I'm sure you can find it on Amazon or something like that. And then in the back of the room, we set up a thing of some books back there, and there's probably only enough for people to take one book. But do know that if you go to the monastery, Abhayagiri's, our website, there is actually a place in the web there that you can actually download books electronically. And if you do want copies of the books that I brought, they do have more there. And so you can request those, and those can actually be mailed to you as well. I'll open it up for questions now. Yes.
Can you explain how Westerners felt about Ajahn Chah, or how they were going to? I mean, there were so many monasteries to choose from. It's just amazing.
Yeah. I'm trying to think. Did everybody hear that question? Like, how do people find, or how do Westerners find Ajahn Chah? I know I've heard the answer to that. I'm trying to think if I can remember.
Or maybe what year it started?
I mean. Yeah, it was Lumpur Samedo was the first. He's an American monk, and he was in Thailand for the Peace Corps. And Ajahn Samedo has been a monk for over 40 years now. And so I believe he didn't ordain with Ajahn Chah. I think he had ordained, and then my recollection is it was actually he was sort of in a monastery. And then a disciple of Ajahn Chah's, is that right? And then Ajahn had taken Lumpur Samedo to meet him. And then Lumpur Samedo didn't really have any instructions, so he had actually learned, it was a Chan, Chinese Zen instruction book, and he had memorized it. He said he read it like 160 times straight through, and sort of memorized it and was using that as his meditation. And then when he went to go meet Ajahn Chah, he had explained to him what he was doing. And in Thailand, and I mean most places, the teachers are really technique oriented. So it's like they'll have a technique, and if you can live with them, if you'll do their technique. And so he was, you know, like, oh no, he's going to tell me I can't do this and stuff like that. And Ajahn Chah's response is, well, what's the technique? You know, what are the results? You know, and Ajahn Chah listened. He goes, okay, well, that sounds good. Really? And so then he stayed, and then it's a pretty tight circle of Westerners there who are ordained, and so word spread probably quite quickly, because I think the monks probably had to go back to Bangkok and things to get their visas to stay and stuff like that, and there's only, you know, a handful of places where Western monks would stay in Bangkok, and so word spread, and then so people would go there. It's interesting that like the local village, because most of them didn't speak Thai, and actually in Ubon they really don't speak Bangkok Thai, they speak more Lao and in Isan. So a lot of the monks spent a lot of time trying to study Thai, and they get there and then find out that they didn't speak Thai, and so the villagers are like, so how can you teach these Westerners, you know, you don't speak English and they don't speak, you know, Lao and stuff like that. And he says, well, how do we communicate with our water buffalo? You know, we can get them to do what we want them to do. He was wonderful that way. And actually, Ajahn Dick is a very senior monk, and Ajahn Mahabua is probably one of the senior Ajahn Mun disciples who's still alive. He's in his 90s. He just visited Abhayagiri this year and spent some time with us. And he was saying that he didn't speak any Thai either when he showed up, and he didn't need to speak the language. He was picking up Dhamma just being with Ajahn Mun or Ajahn Mahabua, and I don't know if he said he could explain it even that well, but it wasn't just sort of just seeing the example, but he was picking something up through the heart, just sort of being in the environment and being around him. And he actually did learn Thai. But yes.
In the last week or two, Mark talked to us about the four ways to enlightenment through a kind of a warrior mentality, or through inquiry, or through a benevolent attitude. I can't remember what the fourth one is, but I was wondering if you could characterize Ajahn Chah's approach to them.
Hmm. It depends on which disciple of his you talk to. Really. But one interesting thing about Ajahn Chah was that he said himself that he, like a lot of people say, like you characterize yourselves and sort of like say what kind of defilement you had to overcome to sort of, you know, become a noble disciple and stuff like that. It might be like, you know, he had lust, or you know, he had doubt, or you know, he had anger and stuff like that. Ajahn Chah said he had all five of them, and he really meant it too. So it's like, and he was a really good teacher that way. So it's like when people would come to him and say, I just have some, he has so much lust and I just can't get over it and stuff like that. And Ajahn Chah said, yeah, I know exactly what you mean. You know, this is what I had to go through. And, you know, or if someone comes, I had all I can't is food fantasies. I can't stop thinking about food. And Ajahn Chah said, yeah, I did the same thing. You know, so I could taste the bananas in my mouth, you know. And so, when you read about his life and things like that, those years where he was a wanderer, I mean, he just totally threw himself into it. He did have this his saying, the Ajahn Chandikos, I think his theme, you know, it's like, may my blood, you know, dry up and my bones turn to dust, you know, sort of, I'm going to do it in this lifetime. And Ajahn Chah had that kind of determination. So he was the warrior, but he also was you know, had the wisdom faculties. And so it's hard for me to know for sure, but probably a combination of all four of them.
Thank you.
Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah. Yeah. Actually, if you just do Google and you just type in Buddhist monastery, I think Abhayagiri is the first one that comes up. It's AB. It's really convenient. But it's Abhayagiri. It actually might be printed in some of those books. I'm not sure if they are or not.
You can send us an email and we'll send you the link too if you can't find it.
Yeah.
There's a book over there. It's all present.
Yeah. Well, what's it about?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, that was just some of the senior nuns in our community. They took a lot of their Dhamma talks and transcribed them and then put them into a book. So it's actually the second one they've done of their community. Yeah. What time do you normally go to? About 8:30? Mm-hmm. Okay. Time. Yes.
Was there ever any explanation why Antashaw, after seeking out so long and walking 250 miles and then 160 miles, why did he stay 3 days?
Yeah, because that's a good question. Yeah, another good question about that too is I was mentioning that Ajahn Chah was a Mahanikai monk, and actually almost everyone who sort of went to go study with him were sort of Mahanikai monks at a certain point, because they'd say it was just so common. And he actually asked them to disrobe and then reordain in the Dhamma order. And Ajahn Chah asked him if he should do that, and Ajahn Mun said no. And there was this one of the accounts that I think it's Ajahn Jayasaro's notes, that Ajahn Mun had this sort of a dream, and it was something about a lotus, which is actually the Ubon, I guess the name is the same. And so when the very next day Ajahn Chah showed up, and he interpreted the dream to mean that a monk was going to show up who was going to become sort of the monk of Ubon. And for some reason, he I think he said later too, it was like that Ajahn Mun felt like that there needed to be good Mahanikai monks too. So he didn't want everyone to sort of switch over. And then he had a couple of teachers too that didn't go over to the Mahanikai. But I think his only staying 3 days was because he got what he needed to get. And so, the sort of the way we run the monasteries in the West now is that, it's like it's a fixed monastery and you come and you live there. As the abbots of our monastery point out, at the time of the Buddha, the word abbot didn't exist. Sort of the way that the monasteries ran was that you had to be in a monastery, in a dwelling, for the 3 months of the rainy season. And the other 9 months, you probably traveled. You just sort of, is it more jungle and things like that? And so it's just you sought out places of solitude, like caves or jungles or just places of being solitude. And so instead of taking the training that you receive and then putting it into practice, so that was much more the emphasis. And then, so even when Ajahn Chah then was starting to starting his training with meditation, that was still the mode that he was practicing under. So. He probably did have the intention, or the desire to go back to see Ajahn Mun, but then it just never happened. Ajahn Mun died shortly actually after he had that encounter, so it's like that would have been, I say, like 47 probably is when he saw him. Ajahn Mun died in 49. Yeah, so it's just a couple of years later. So that's probably another reason he hadn't gone back to see him. But that's sort of of all the other teachers too. He's like, he never stayed with anybody that long. It's just sort of, and I don't think that's totally uncommon for many of the monks. Because even like Ajahn Mun's close disciples, a lot of them, it's like, Ajahn Mun once got an assignment where he was going to be appointed an abbot of a monastery in Chiang Mai. And the very next day, he was gone. And didn't tell any of his disciples where he was going. And there's like stories where like 2 years, his disciples were searching for him, just trying to get more teachings and things. So it was tough back then. It's interesting with Ajahn Jayasaro, because he's the main source where I got a lot of this information, was that when he was talking to Ajahn Chah, he writes it was more the warrior kind of spirit and things like that, and he would talk to Ajahn Chah and say, well, do we need to sort of do these sort of practices the way you did, sort of going out there it's like, one thing it's interesting to understand is that if you read the sort of biographies and things, it was very austere and like Ajahn Pasno, the abbot of the monastery I'm from, was saying that like at the very beginning when he got there, like if they had a drink, like a tea or something like that, maybe once a week, that was about the normal. You know, and it was just one boiled pot of tea. It wasn't like you didn't have any choices or anything like that, and there probably wouldn't be any sugar or soy milk or anything like that to go with it. You know, probably borepet, which is this really very bitter herb that they would have. And so any other questions? Yeah.
I was curious if there were any theories as to what Ajahn Chah had died of, what had caused him to have these seizures.
There probably is, but I'm not sure if I've ever. They think that initially, though, he probably did have a stroke. I don't know if they actually ever really figured that out. There's some quite amazing stories when he was sick, one sort of miraculous story is it was probably like well into when he was in his coma. One thing is that they took very good care of Ajahn Chah, and so like in the 10 years that he was in a coma, like he never developed a bed sore in that whole 10 years, and they. They had a constant team of monks sort of taking care of him. They'd go in shifts, and he did have sort of royal patronage and stuff like that. So I think the king and queen built a hospital, or you know, not a hospital, but just a. I think I've seen it. The cabin was about the size of this room here, and it was a nursing station and a place to receive guests and things like that, and places for the monks to rest or to meditate while they were there. So it's a little bit bigger than this room, but. So the monks would, you know, smell a lot of. It was actually good because they got to sort of take care of the teacher that way. But they said it was, you know, extremely difficult to be, you know, if you're with somebody who's in a coma to actually sort of, you know, keep remembering that they're actually are alive and that they're real and they're human beings and stuff. And these two monks were arguing with each other about how they should take care of Ajahn Chah. And you would never sort of do anything like that in front of your teacher. And he'd been, I think, in a coma for at least 3 or 4 years and hadn't spoken anything at this point. These two monks are arguing, and all of a sudden, Ajahn Chah sat up in bed and and spat, and it went right between them and stuck on the wall. And the two monks are, sorry, Ajahn, and got down and bowed. And so he still was, they say he was still there the whole time. Yeah, but what caused him to die? I'm not sure. Yeah. So one thing is, I did spend one of my years so far in training in Thailand, and Wat Pa Nanacha is the branch monastery for Westerners, and it's actually walking distance. You could sort of go on your own round and then walk over to Wat Pa Phong for the meal if you wanted to, So a group of us went over to go pay respects, and I hadn't actually been over to Wat Pa Phong yet, so we went over in the van, and as soon as we entered the monastery, there's close to 100 monks live there, and I think about 100 nuns as well, and as soon as I walked in, it was just this feeling of peace just overcame me when I came into the monastery, and then the way the monastery is built is very well thought out, the way they design things to sort of have people come in and see the things that they, you know, the Thai people want to see, and then not disturb the community. And so, you know, like I was there, and you know, it's like you couldn't believe 200 monastics were living there, and then at the very sort of back, in the back corner, is Ajahn Chah's kuti. So they've still kept it, and occasionally they'll put very senior monks up, like Ajahn Mahabhu was staying there at one point when I came by. But I went and sat underneath of it, and basically it's a large cabin about the size of this, you know, half of it, or only a third of it actually being a room, and then the rest of it's an open deck. And then underneath of it, though, it's a big concrete slab, and it's on stilts. And then Ajahn Chah would meet people underneath the cabin, you know, say every night, or from whenever he's just doing teaching, which sometimes could be 20 hours a day. Sort of, as soon as his meal is over, he'd just sit down, and whoever showed up, that's who talked. So there's no such thing as a private interview. You just sort of, if you had questions, you show up. And actually, I was going to read the introduction to that Food for the Heart, because there's a sort of beautiful, Ajahn Amaro described a scene where this young man had was there, and there was like a governor of the province was there, and some visiting nuns had come over from some Western nuns had come over to ask some questions, and this local villagers, and then this young man was in the back, and it turns out that his younger brother had just died from malaria, and he was like this really tough guy and sort of a gang member and stuff like that. And Ajahn Amaro describes Ajahn Chah as sort of very casually, sort of answering questions to other people, and he sees the young man. He sort of coaxes him up front, and then just by the way he was presenting, asking the questions and stuff, got the young man to see that like death happens to everybody, and that it's not uncommon, and then the guy could see that it was just his selfishness, and then forget exactly how he writes about it, but just, this whole thing happened in front of a confess, or not because they confess this, but sort of saw the truth of this, and then they started crying just out of relief, like, oh yeah, that's right, and then sort of really soothing and healing for this young man. It happened completely in front of all these strangers, but Ajahn Chah just had this way of bringing people in and being able to teach them that way, and so it all would happen there. But so I went, and the tour was, we had taken some people over, and I knew we were going to be there for a couple of hours, like at least an hour, and this is sort of the beginning part of the tour, and I just sat down, and I just felt this real sense of peace, just really overwhelming, and so everybody else left, and I just sat there, I didn't even move, and then I knew when they were leaving, so then I got up and left, and then for a while after that, whenever I was sitting in meditation, all of a sudden this image of the sitting underneath the kuti would come up into my mind, and it would just fill me with this peace. But Mark was mentioning, I mentioned that story to him, and he said he went to Ajahn Mun's cremation, and it was the exact same sort of experience. Sort of you enter into that space, and it's just pervasive. So it's interesting. I don't have any, I have some theories, but I don't know. Why that happens.
Any last questions? Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
So, although a Buddhist monk and Buddhist nuns, they don't, in this tradition at least, the nuns also don't receive money. And their monasteries do receive money and support the monks and the nuns with their independent foundations that take care of the monastery needs and the travel expenses of the monks and nuns. So when we have a guest speaker, as most of you know, we share the dana, the donations between the needs of the center and the guest teachers. So if you'd like to support Venerable Jyoti Palo's monastic life at his monastery, or monasteries now, that he practices at, Abhayagiri and then the Arrow River Forest Hermitage near Thunder Bay. You can leave a donation before you leave. And also please receive the gift from Abhayagiri Monastery that Jyoti Palo brought with him, the books. You can take a book if you'd like, or one of the CDs. They're freely offered in the In this tradition, when a monk or a nun writes a book or translates, transcribes some of the talks of their teachers, they never or usually never sell the books. They just offer freely. So generally, people give money, and then with that money, the monastery prints up a bunch of books and then gives them away freely. So they're called free distribution books. So please take one if you'd like. And we do have some other programs. Venerable Jyoti Palo mentioned that Ajahn Punadamo from the monastery up near Thunder Bay, he'll be down doing a day-long retreat, which I believe is not full, but he'll be speaking on Sunday, December 16th, so you can keep that in mind. And more soon, Mary Jo Mehta will be speaking this coming Saturday, the 17th, 7 o'clock, same format as tonight. She's going to be some of you know, Mary Jo Metal, she has a deep connection with the Buddhist tradition, the Theravada Buddhist tradition, but also the Catholic tradition. And she's going to be talking about the paramis, the 10 perfections of the heart, and connecting it with the Holy Spirit, the teachings of the Holy Spirit. So I thought, oh, that's really an interesting topic for a talk. That will be this Saturday. So please join us for that if you'd like. There's also a few spots left in the day-long retreat on Saturday. Any other announcements for the community that people have? Sue, did you want to make an announcement?
The full moon walk is a week from Saturday at 7:30 to 8:45. I'd like to see a lot of people there. Meet here. This morning.
We'll be serving Venerable Jyoti Kalo a meal on Wednesday morning at 10:30. If anybody would like to join us for that, you could just check with me. It's a chance. One of the traditions in Asia is to support the monastics, the monks and nuns, by feeding them their daily meal. And they generally are done eating by 12 noon, so we usually start early for that meal. So if you'd like to bring some food or just come and share the meal, that's at 10:30. You can just check in with me later. And finally, we have a reception tonight. If you'd like to have a cup of tea and get to know some of the community members, or just say hello to Venerable Jyoti Kalo, you can stay. We have some cheese and some other treats. So thanks again, everybody, for coming, and thank you, Venerable Jyoti Kalo.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.